Okay, well, I think Kimberly did a great job. She has everyone exactly where I want you. One of our natural antidepressants that I've found, because this is something, an area that I've been really fascinated with, is looking at what actually makes us feel well naturally, and is play. And so you kind of brought that to us this morning. Another thing came to my mind, which was when I was young and was given a test, I didn't know the answer either. It was a Hebrew test, actually, and I really didn't know any Hebrew. And on the name it said Shem, which means name, at the top. And the person next to me wrote David, which was David in Hebrew. I looked on his paper, it says Shem, wrote David, I wrote David. I didn't get that answer right either. And so, okay, well, I'm so humbled to be here tonight, to have all of you here, and hopefully this will be a good time. We'll learn something. We'll get some practical stuff out that'll be helpful for us moving forward. And so, how many people here are, just so I get a sense, are aware of what mindfulness is? Okay. So, how many people, let me say, are not as much aware, kind of new in some way? Okay. So, let me just define it, just to give you a sense of it. So mindfulness just means awareness. So it's about intentionally paying attention to what's here. It could be really anything at all, while putting aside our program biases. And one thing that, one way of doing that, because we developed so many program biases growing up in so many different ways, internally towards our own emotions, and externally towards the people around us. And so one of the ways of doing this is by starting to get curious about life. And one thing that we notice is that as we're paying attention to this presentation for the next 45 minutes, there's one thing that I know for sure, which is your minds are going to wander off from time to time. It might have already happened. So your minds are going to wander off. And this is how I know that. There was a study done in 2007 by a couple people, Dan Gilbert and Matthew Killingsworth. So Dan Gilbert out of Harvard, Matthew Killingsworth was his postdoc at the time, they created something that those of you who have iPhones, I can't get it, but those of you who have iPhones can get it on your phone, called trackyourhappiness.org. So trackyourhappiness is the name of the app. Trackyourhappiness.org is the actual website you can go to. And what they did was they created an app where they pinged your phone. So thousands of people have taken this at this point. They pinged your phone to say, are you paying attention to what you're intending to pay attention to? And then, how are you feeling in this moment? And so they got results over thousands and thousands of people. They always said, so how often do you think our minds are wandering from what we're intending to pay attention to? Any thoughts? 80% of the time? 90% of the time? 91? This is like, what's that game show where you're gonna try to get closer and closer?
Price is Right,
that's right. So you'll be heartened to find out that our minds wander on average about 47% of the time, except when we're having sex. That's about 10% of the time, and it probably depends on who your partner is. But, no, that's actually in the research study, and no one really, at least I don't know, I haven't investigated how they figured that out. So there it is. So 47% of the time. So what does that mean? That means that half of our life, we're not here. We're not here for our life half of the time. And so some of you might say, well, it's more for me. Other people might say, it's less for me. Well, okay, but half of our life on average, we're not here. So here's the thing. During this presentation, your mind's going to wander off maybe half of the time. I'm not going to take it personally because I know it's science, right? So there it is. So this is what we're going to do. When your mind wanders off, this entire thing that we're going to do here is going to be a mindfulness practice. So your intention is to pay attention to me, pay attention to how you're feeling, what you're thinking maybe in that moment. And when your mind wanders off, I want you to become aware of that. And when you become aware of it, and see if you can notice where your mind wandered to. Spend a moment with it. Don't yank it back. Don't worry about what I'm saying. This is actually a more important practice than anything I'm going to say tonight. So when your mind wanders off, see if you can touch it. So this is a practice called see, touch, go. Touch it and gently go back to being here. Because one thing we know about habits and how we evolve as human beings in this world is what we intentionally practice and repeat over time starts to become automatic. So what would the days, weeks, and months ahead be like if we practiced being more gentle with ourselves when we wandered off of our intentions, what would be different? To ask ourselves that simple question, it's a very simple question. Can we be more gentle with ourselves when we wandered off of our intentions? So that's what we're going to practice here over the next 45 minutes or something like that. So before we launch into this, I want to tell you a little bit about my story. On both sides of my family, both my mom's side and my dad's side, both of their parents were alcoholics. And so alcoholism in particular is strung heavily throughout my family. And so it's not a surprise to me that as I grew up, 6 years old, my parents got divorced, I didn't know how to really express my emotions, handle my emotions. I was kind of a mess, always getting in fights with people. And years later, when I was in the Silicon Valley, in the dot-com boom, I was working hard and playing a whole lot harder. And everything seemed to be okay, because I was doing well in my job. And I was functioning in that way, but I wasn't really functioning. And it wasn't until the night, so here were so many times when I realized that I was abusing my body and my mind to the point of complete abuse. And I tried to stop using the cocaine, the various ecstasy, different things like that. And alcohol, actually, surprisingly, was not my thing. It was not an issue for me as much. But it was these different kind of, I wanted the adrenaline, to get pumped up more. And so, I couldn't really stop. And so it wasn't until this night where I was in a broken down limousine, South of Market in San Francisco, and I was with a guy that I told my friends, if you ever catch me with this guy, you know that I've kind of hit rock bottom. You can kind of like pull me out of the game at this point. And there I was staring at him in the face, trying to, and he had like a beat up prostitute with him, and there he was, and I was looking into the shadow of a man, and I was seeing my reflection. And so there I was, and in that moment I kind of woke up just for that moment, and I said, instead of saying to myself, what's wrong with me, which was something that had visited me so many times, I don't know if anyone here has ever had that kind of thought, right? What's wrong with me? It turned into, for a moment, what's wrong with this situation? What's wrong with this situation? And I don't need to treat myself this way. I'm worth more than this. There's something about this is not right. So I got in San Francisco, you can walk anywhere really. So I got out of the thing and I walked back home. And I ended up taking myself out for 30 days and I went to a retreat down in LA for a little while and just kind of questioning everything about life. I wasn't allowed my phone, I wasn't allowed anything. And I found like this real spiritual sense about what I felt connected to as far as something being kind of greater than myself. And then I went back to San Francisco, and what happened? I went back to my old ways, because that's the way our brain works in a lot of ways, is that it's built off cues in our environment. So I got cued, I didn't surround myself with a different support system, I just got cued into the same old patterns. But something was different, I had a seed planted in me now. And I realized that I couldn't live this way, I needed to surround myself by different people, and that's when I actually ended up kind of plucking myself out and, as any good therapist would do, going back to school to kind of, work on my stuff. And after being in therapy for a long time, of course. And so there it was. There was the beginning of my journey, in a lot of ways, of self-discovery to recognize that this shame that I've been experiencing for so long, that it wasn't until I stared it in the face and recognized that vulnerability for me was really where the gold was, that being able to learn how to be with what's here instead of allowing my mind to pop out and try to avoid it is really where the gold was, where the answer was. There's a wonderful cartoon by a woman named Kathy Thorne who said, I'd like to live in the moment, unless the moment's unpleasant, in which case I'll go eat a cookie. And so, there it is. That's the way our brains operate. That's the operating system we're given as we're kind of born, and then we grow up in these families or whatever it is, and then we're given this sense of needing to get away from what's here. Mindfulness is a practical training to teach ourselves on an experiential level It's a very different part of the brain that we're accessing here, to be able to learn how to be with what's here, the shame, the vulnerability, the thing that's driving us to get away from this moment. And so I started a journey and got trained in, I took a class called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, which is an 8-week course started by Jon Kabat-Zinn many years ago about how to treat people with chronic pain to lower their pain. Because ultimately, pain is the first thing that happens. The second thing that happens is the hating of the pain, the hating of ourselves in that moment. That's really where the suffering lies. Mindfulness allows us to turn the volume down on that and just learn how to be with the pain. So for people with chronic pain, what happened was over the course of 8 weeks, their perception of the pain really lowered. In fact, they felt like they weren't really in the same kind of pain anymore because they weren't hating themselves so much or hating the pain so much, which is really where the suffering came from. And so I got trained as an MBSR teacher, then another program called Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy, which is for helping people not relapse into depression. All along the way, I was learning about the science of it, the neurosciences. That's what was really interesting. That was another thing that was really interesting to me, was how is this impacting, what is the science showing us about how learning how to be present to our lives actually impacts our own health and well-being, impacts our resiliency. And so what I found was that there's major impacts. For example, being able to name something and be with something turns on this part of our brain behind our forehead called the prefrontal cortex, which is involved with executive function, which is involved with impulse control. I don't know if anybody here has any of those types of issues, impulse control issues. But impulse control, or also making short-term decisions in perspective of long-term goals. Anyone have any issues with that? So we need to kind of turn this thing on, right? And then when you're doing that, you're turning the volume down. This is a bit of a generalization, but just is good enough for right now. Turn the volume down on this part of the brain called the amygdala, which is, as many of you know, has been called the fear circuit. It's what lights up with when we feel anger. If you look at someone who's been highly anxious or depressed over time, you look at their brain, you'll see oftentimes an enlarged amygdala, meaning like there's an oversensitization to kind of stimuli that are there. At least that's the way that I interpret it. And so I started looking at this. It's very fascinating. So there are things I realized that are natural antidepressants. So when we think of the word antidepressant, we oftentimes think of a pill. And that's okay. That can help people kind of do the work that they need to do in this world. That's really helpful. But there are things that science is now discovering that are natural antidepressants. And not only do these kind of buoy resiliency in us, but they also help us uncover the happiness that lies underneath the cloud of judgment, that self-judgment and self-criticism that lies within us, that kind of dampens us down or makes us feel really anxious. And so here they are. I'm going to tell you what they are, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit of the science of them. Then we're going to do a practice with one of them, so you can kind of experience it for yourself. The first one is mindfulness. That's the first one. It's the ground of it. Learning how to become more aware, training ourselves to be more aware. I don't know who couldn't use more awareness, really. Not the kind of awareness where I'm mindful, F-U-L-L, my mind is full type of thing. Am I mindful or am I mindful? Not that kind of fullness. It's more of this kind of awareness that I'm not this fullness that's here, but this fullness is happening to me right now, and I'm actually having a little bit more freedom from it because I have some space and perspective from it. One of the quotes that I love so much, that makes so much sense to me, and it's the basis for the book The Now Effect that I wrote, which is from Viktor Frankl. So many of you might know this quote. Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust survivor, psychiatrist, neurologist. He had the audacity to make meaning out of his trauma, right, of being in concentration camps. And the meaning he found was helping other people find their meaning. That was the purpose that he found. I'm going to help other people find their meaning, because what I realized in looking at the people in the concentration camps was the people that were surviving were the people that had a sense of purpose and their life purpose and meaning. I'm gonna live to finish this book. I gotta live to see my kids and my wife grow up. I'm gonna live for the next sunset that's there. There's a sense of purpose and meaning that's there. And so his purpose and meaning was to help people find their purpose and meaning. So anyway, this quote was attributed to him. Between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space lies our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. So I'll say that again because it's so important, and because it's not written here, and you're not writing, it's not recorded in that way. But between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space lies our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. Mindfulness, basically, is the practice of settling, knowing, becoming more intimate with that space between stimulus and response. And as we settle into that space more, we widen that space. So what's in that space? Choice, perspective, freedom. What happens when we intentionally practice and repeat something over and over and over? We seem to get more of it. Choice, perspective, and freedom. Now, another way of understanding this is the way we perceive something and make decisions, make kind of gut decisions or snap judgments in any moment, is when you see something, your brain reaches back and references everything that it knows, experiences it's had, autobiographical things, emotional things, and it spits back a perception or a judgment. That's important, that's not important, that's urgent, that's not urgent. That's fair, that's not fair, that's right, that's wrong. And we just think that's just the way it is, because that's what we're thinking in that moment. So one of the things that this allows us to do is create new experiences for the mind to reference, so that it picks it up. It's like it's referencing this in the moment. So here we are, we're having a difficult experience, right? This is a hard moment that we're experiencing. Maybe not. Maybe you might be experiencing this moment. I'm making a generalization. And what is happening is it reaches back and it picks up self-judgment. And it grabs it and it starts circulating it. That's not really what we're needing in that moment. But that's what's being picked up. If we kind of settle in mindfulness, awareness practices, if we settle in self-compassion, which is the practice of knowing that we're suffering or having a difficult moment with this inclination to want to support ourselves in that moment, which is radically different from what we usually give ourselves, which is when we're not feeling well, we get self-judgment, self-criticism. What's wrong with me? I'm defective. I'm deficient. I don't belong. Look at everyone else. Everyone else is so happy around me. What's wrong with me? That's what we get. But that's not what we're needing. We know that. Right? And so there's, it's the same kind of scenario. If you see a child who's crying or having a difficult moment, you don't go over to that child and kick them across the face. Right? Or, that might have happened to some of us here. But what I mean by that is that's not a healing type of response to that child. Well, but we don't do that to ourselves. My mom has my mom's an equine, she's a psychologist for like over 30 years, but she's also an equine therapist. Equine psychologist, whatever you call it, equine assisted psychotherapy. So she has a ranch, right? And so she in Santa Clarita. It's called Denim and Dirt. It's a fantastic place. And so she has horses, miniature horses, and miniature donkeys. And so she tells me this story about a month ago, adult child of an alcoholic. And so she tells me this story about a month ago, and she goes, I was sitting there with my donkeys. These donkeys. By the way, if you've never been with miniature donkeys, it's like a really amazing experience. She's sitting there with these miniature donkeys, and she's like, oh, you're so sweet. I love you so much. I just want to be with you. She has this moment. She goes, I don't talk to myself that way. It's this, as many of you just had this aha, this little aha, yeah. So, that's what we're needing. We don't give ourselves. We have to kind of train that. We have to train that in a way. So there's systematic ways of training that. So therapy is one way, it's powerful. There's nothing more powerful than community, in my experience. Nothing more powerful. Well, what I mean by that, to kind of facilitate change, community creates the necessary cues in our environment to help support us to make the changes we're wanting to make. So self-compassion, recognizing our own suffering with this inclination to want to support ourselves, also just being here as an exercise of self-compassion, because the other element of that is recognizing the common humanity behind our suffering as human beings. Nothing that anyone has experienced in this room is new to humanity. This is something, though we all have our own experiences, everything that we've experienced in our lives has been experienced by other people in this world. There's a common humanity behind our own struggle and our joys in life as well. And so this self-compassion creates a connection, which kind of increases our sense of oxytocin, which makes us feel safe. Anyways, we'll get into some of that. So then the next natural antidepressant, so is mindfulness, self-compassion, and then there's purpose, which I was talking about before, which is compassion. Compassion has been shown, compassion with this recognizing other people's suffering and wanting to support them, being of service in a lot of ways, is powerful. It's in all the world's wisdom traditions, it's certainly in this lineage. And so it creates these, it's been shown to create this left prefrontal shift in the brain. So I mentioned there's this prefrontal cortex, and I mentioned kind of what it's responsible for. The right side of the right prefrontal cortex, of the prefrontal cortex, lights up when we're trying to avoid things. The left side lights up when we're trying to approach things, when we're approaching things. What's interesting about that is the right side also lights up when we're feeling depressed, anxious, or other uncomfortable emotions that are there. I always say uncomfortable, actually, because love is uncomfortable. It's mixed up with all kinds of, but you know, more negative emotions was used for sake of understanding ourselves here. We try so much with the vocabulary that we have, but we're so limited with our English language and other languages. The left side lights up when we're approaching things, but also with the more kind of positive emotions, you might say. And so compassion and mindfulness both create left prefrontal shifts in the brain, which is also associated with resiliency. So before we do anything else, I'm going to give you a sense of what resiliency is. So I'm going to bring you through a short practice. Okay, so go ahead and I'm going to invite you to close your eyes. This isn't a meditation, although we'll start with a short mindfulness piece, but this is actually going to bring you through just a visualization to give you an experience of something. So start off by just taking a couple deep breaths. Noticing how you have the luxury to do that in this moment, and how that's there more often than we think. I want you to just notice your body sitting here for a moment. And just ask yourself the question, where am I starting from physically right now, this moment of my life? This is the first moment of all the moments that unfold in my life going forward. How is my body feeling? If there's any tension anywhere from the face or anywhere else, notice how with this awareness you might just allow that to soften or adjust your body in some way. And now I'm going to ask you to visualize something. So imagine waking up in the morning and you really got a rough night's sleep. This might have been your morning this morning. You really got a rough night's sleep, your body's feeling kind of tired, you can feel a little irritable a bit, and you get out of your bed. On your way to the bathroom, you stub your toe on the corner of the bed. Things aren't getting better. And you have to take a shower and the hot water's out. This morning's really not going your way. And then you get your tea or your coffee or whatever you get, but something about it just isn't as good as it usually is, or not really as satisfied with it. And then you look on the shelf and you see that envelope that you got yesterday, and there it is. You open it up and it's a letter from the IRS saying you owe $10,000 in back taxes from the year before. Forgot to pay. They missed. You decide to go outside and take a walk. As you're walking down the street from this morning, from the distance you see someone walking towards you. As they get a little closer, you recognize them, they're a friendly acquaintance. And so from the place that you're in, you muster up a smile, you wave, and they just look at you and walk on by. Noticing what you're feeling, what you're thinking. Okay, deep breath. You can open your eyes if you want to. You can kind of shake that off if you want to as well, if you feel like that's something you're wanting to do. Notice how with awareness you have the choice to do. And so now closing your eyes once again. Now we're going to imagine a different morning. So here's a morning where you actually did get a good night's sleep. And feeling rested, you get out of your bed, you go to the bathroom and into the shower. And in the shower is that new soap that you just bought. Mm. peppermint or lavender or whatever it is, and you take an inhalation of it, and it's just like it's a spa morning almost. And you get out of the shower and you go towards the kitchen, and you eat your breakfast. Coffee, tea tastes good. You look on the shelf. There's an envelope that was waiting there since yesterday. Publishers Clearing House has now chosen you as their next winner. Feeling pretty buoyant in this moment, and you decide to take a walk outside, sunny day after all, and you walk outside, and as you're walking, you see someone coming towards you in the distance, and it's a friendly acquaintance, you notice, and as they get closer to you, you smile and you wave, and they just look at you and walk on by, noticing what you're thinking, what you're feeling. Breathe in, breathe out, open your eyes. Let me just ask a couple of people, what did you notice? How many people here, okay, yeah, hand up over there.
First time,
shooting pain down the back, and she said, what the fuck, what?
Why
didn't they say hi? Yeah, what's wrong? Yeah, what about the second time?
The second time I didn't have any physical healing, negative healing, and then I was just happy, it didn't really matter.
Okay, second time didn't really matter, no physical manifestation or anything, and it didn't really matter. How many people had an experience of, thank you for that, okay. How many people had an experience of the first time it was a little stickier, it was kind of like, this is about me, what did I do wrong? How many people like that? Yeah, a lot of people. Okay. How many people the second, and you may, by the way, you don't have to have had this experience. If you had a different type of experience, don't allow the, hey, wait, I don't really belong here kind of to seep into your mind. Everyone's different, right? And so how many people had the experience of the second time where it was just kind of like water off a duck's feathers, or maybe it was like, what's wrong with them? Or maybe they didn't see me, or something like that. Okay, a number of people. Resiliency, we can always say, well, resiliency is, yeah, it's about feeling good. Okay, if we're feeling good, then we're obviously more resilient. We can know that cognitively. But to have an experience of it is very different. It's very different. And so resiliency is about feeling well. It is about feeling well. So it's no wonder why positive emotions like gratitude, which is certainly embedded in this lineage here, gratitude, giving, purpose, these types of things, joy, these are kind of make us more resilient. So what's the problem? Why don't we all just walk around with a smile on our face and just be resilient? What's the issue? Anybody have any idea what the problem is? Why don't we just like be positive all the time? What's the problem?
Life is in session.
Life is in session, okay. So there's that. There's the software needs to be upgraded and changed. Okay. Yeah.
It's the nature of mind.
Yes. It's this like sponge-like thing we have in between this our ears right here. It's our brain. Yep.
Well, actually, I've read that our programmed to negativity is what kept us alive.
Yes, that's right. So we have an evolution. There's an evolutionary reason for this negativity bias, right? We have this negativity bias, and I'll just explain this. So as you're saying, people who were years and years ago who were sitting on the grass and just, you know, loving life and staring up at the sky in total bliss, didn't make it. They weren't the ones that were sitting around focusing on the danger. The ones that were focusing on the danger are the ones that passed on their genes to us. And so where our brains are highly crafted over thousands of years to pay attention to what's negative more than to pay attention to what's positive. Okay, so we know this. So we're getting a sense of this. Then you have the software from growing up, all of that to kind of build on top of that. And so, right, kind of like a wall of mud that's kind of seeping, you know, through that in that way. And so there we are. So we're biased in this way. Now, we know this in some ways too, because not only do we know this from this kind of evolutionary perspective, but a guy named John Cacioppo at the University of Chicago did a study where he had people, he threw up images on the screen, And he hooked all the people up to brain scanning machines, and what he found was that when people were looking at negative images, images of maybe a cat run over by a car, or maybe somebody who was roughed up a little bit, versus somebody smiling or people jumping for joy, it lit up their brain. The activity in their brain was so far, it was so significantly more, so much greater than when they were looking at the positive images, or versus just neutral images. So literally, that's the neuroscience also behind our negativity bias that we have. We also know a guy named John Gottman up in Seattle. Some of you might know who he is, right? Who do you know who he is? Okay, a handful of people. So this is a guy that's basically for many years has a whole group of people who takes, who will have a couple together, and they'll videotape you, and they'll be staring at you, they'll be looking at your mic, they'll slow the tape down and look at your micro expressions. And once you do something over and over and over again, you start to develop some mastery with it. And he says, he contends in his research, that he can kind of look at a couple and within 5 minutes tell you whether that relationship's gonna work out or not. And what he found is, what's interesting about that, what he found is, and we gotta take that all with a grain of salt, of course, right? What we found is that we need to have in a relationship about 5 positive interactions to 1 negative interaction. Because the negative interaction is so much stickier. If you're walking down the street and people walk towards you and say, "Wow, you look beautiful today. That's such a great outfit you have. What have you done with your hair? Or you're just looking so buoyant. You're glowing today. Something must have really gone right with you today." And you have somebody who walks by you. 10 people walk by you, say that. One person walks by you and says, "What a jerk you are. You look like crap today." You know, which one are you going to be thinking about for the next rest of the day? Right? It's just so we don't need the neuroscience necessarily. We just kind of know that. That there it is, that's the negativity bias in play. And so there it is. So we have this brain to contend with. And so what do we know now about the brain, which is fascinating, is that we can use our minds to change our brain throughout the lifespan in a variety of different ways. This isn't something just to kind of put on a poster and say like, okay, well we can like kind of transform our brain into looking like a dinosaur, or we can transform it to looking like a, you know, this. There's certain things we know about certain areas of our brain that we've kind of found to be plastic in some ways, where we can rebuild certain areas that are important when it comes to issues that have been impaired, areas that have been impaired. So for example, if you've lived with stress as a child or as an adult, and you feel like you have a hard time remembering things maybe, or that memory doesn't really stick, there's a part of your brain called the hippocampus, which is involved with learning memory and putting things in context. What's interesting about that is that mindfulness, and as well as other things like exercise and other things as well, it's not just mindfulness has been shown to grow new neural connections in the hippocampus, among other areas as well. And so we're starting just to learn this stuff, and so it's really inspiring. This is an incredible story of hope that we've kind of learned in the field of neuroscience, I think, for the past, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, and longer before that, if you're going to count animal studies. Before that, so we have to intentionally build this sense of paying attention, maybe to what's good in life, what's happening that's good, because we know that we're going to be biased towards what's not good in life, and that stuff's going to also be a lot stickier as well. Barbara Fredrickson, who wrote a book called Love 2.0, she's done a lot of research in the field of kind of like, you know, well-being as well. Found that there's about a 3-to-1 ratio for feeling well in life. You need to have 3 kind of good experiences in the day to 1 kind of negative experience in the day to kind of feel well. So there it is. So we have mindfulness, which creates that left prefrontal shift. We have self-compassion, which there's no neuroscience really out there around right now because it's a newer field. Newer field in the field of science anyway. We've all kind of experienced this idea of recognizing our own suffering with this inclination to want to maybe be kind towards ourselves. So I'm going to do a little practice with you before we move on. We just did a little practice in this way, but this is going to be more of a mindfulness / compassion practice. And what I want you to do as you do this is I want you to bring a beginner's mind to this. And so one of the essential attitudes of mindfulness is the idea of noticing things as if for the first time, having a sense of fresh eyes. And one other way of saying that is just being curious about what's here. and just see what you notice. Okay. So go ahead. I'm going to ask you, let me tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask you to think up a difficult experience from the past week. If you have trouble with that, bless you. But something that's like mildly stressful. You know, it doesn't, not the most difficult experience. Just like something that was, you know, maybe it was on the road, you got agitated by something, or you got a phone call from someone and it wasn't exactly what you wanted, or maybe you did something and felt like you fell short, or maybe you were really getting stuck in the mind trap of self-doubt and self-worth and feeling deficient, defective again, or a sense of not belonging. Maybe there was that going on. Something. If you have a lot of them, just choose one, it's okay. You're not gonna get this wrong. If you have trouble thinking of one or choosing between one and you feel agitated, just use that. Because in this present moment, you're feeling not well, so you use that. You can just use that. Okay, so gently close your eyes. If you'd like to keep them open, perfectly fine. Go ahead and keep them open. That's fine too. This is an internal practice, so I'll just suggest you close your eyes. And so a couple deep breaths. And so once again, you can pause. This is like an incredibly effective practice to do. You can pause, you can just, in this moment, relax your body. And in this moment, start to think of, you might have already thought of one, start to think of, in the past week or month, something like that, some kind of difficult experience you had that brought up an uncomfortable feeling. A feeling of sadness or guilt or shame, or frustration, agitation, or maybe something that was just stressful. This may have been an experience you had by yourself or with another person. Maybe you got in a fight with somebody or you felt like you fell short in a moment just with yourself, didn't accomplish what you wanted to. And as you're picturing this, picture what was actually happening. What was said, who was there, what about this experience was difficult, it's hard. The more you can picture it and feel the flavor of it, the better. And as you're feeling this, see if you can recognize where this feeling is in the body. This part's not so easy. If you can't do that and you feel stressed around that, just use that. That's okay. Where is this in the body? Just in this moment, just name it. This moment. This is a difficult moment. Now practicing, just playing with this, entertaining this for a moment, taking your hand and putting it on your heart. Allow yourself to just be curious about this for a moment. And just sensing the hand there on your heart, sensing the connection there and the actual sensation of the hand laying there. Without any expectation, but more with a curiosity, just noticing what arises. And now taking your other hand and placing it on top of that hand. It's as if the first hand is making a connection, the second hand is supporting that hand. Just allowing your chest to feel the weight of those hands there, the temperature, connection. And now taking the top hand and putting it on the abdomen while the other hand remains on the heart. And just noticing what this feels like. The friends. I'd like to connect with myself in this way. And then taking the top hand on the heart, just placing it on the abdomen. And so both hands just being on the abdomen. And just exploring, what's this like? Noticing the sensation of this, just breathing. These postures you felt most connected to, and going back to that posture just for a moment. Or if none of them felt connected to none of them, you can just put your hands down, it's fine too. This memory, this experience was a difficult moment, and in life there's difficult moments. This may just be a gesture of being kind to yourself. And as we bring this practice to a close, remembering these words by a poet Hafiz, which said, "Had the rose ever opened up and showed to the world all its beauty? Felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened." And so now bringing awareness to the face as you gently, if your eyes are closed, letting the light seep through opening your eyes. So let me get a sense, maybe we can hear a couple voices. What did you notice in doing that practice? So just the facts. Let's say you were kind of exploring from a distant planet, inhabiting this body for the first time. What were you aware of? Yeah. Ah, fresh. Can everyone hear her? No? She said, okay, so let me just repeat. So she said that she had a really fresh and difficult experience from last night and this morning. And so she brought this up, and when she put her hands on her heart, she felt this kind of flood of compassion, this kind of soothing sensation go over her. And when she put her hands on that again and switched them, she also felt this kind of continual kind of flooding of soothing compassion kind of happening. Compassion being like, I'm caring about myself, self-compassion. Yeah, something was soothing about that. And she said, I literally felt like I was going into a place of repair. Yeah, it's powerful. So there lies inside of you, in that way, lies inside of you, your own inner healer in that way, what I call a natural antidepressant, a natural antidepressant. So anybody else? Anybody else? You didn't have to have that experience, by the way. You could have, like, well, it just felt weird to put my hands on my body and I did nothing other really happened. That's perfectly fine, too. Don't worry. Okay, yeah. I was trying to remember the experience. As soon as I touched my heart, I got out of my mind, and I might say, into my life. Yeah.
Yeah, I was in the pain or the memory of the experience, and I had my heart. I just felt like it was a second person, like my mother, like a person covering myself.
He was in this pain, this difficult experience, and when he put his hand on his heart, he almost felt like it was a second person, like his mother caring for him, right? And like that reparenting in some way, sense of reparenting, which goes again with the kind of repair. So our natural antidepressants that we have, pretty simple practice, right? And again, you didn't have, not everyone had to have that experience. You might have, again, felt like, you know, so I do a variety of different practices with different people. And one time I was dealing with this man who had a lot of abuse growing up. And I said, well, what happens as we're talking about this? You put your hand on your heart. He said, okay, I'll try that. This is how close he could get to his hand on his heart. Because it was too painful to get closer. We don't all have to just force this. We have to kind of feel into what feels right for me. One thing that we know about the brain, this is another kind of note about this, is that when we're actually present with something, so there's an area of the brain called the cortical midline right here, which is involved with kind of mind wandering. It's also when we're trying to fix and problem solve things, which happens with our emotional lives oftentimes. I don't feel well, and so I need to fix this, and I need to fix this feeling that's here. Anybody resonate with that? So anyway, yeah. So one thing that we know about that is that when we are present to our bodies, let's say, it's inversely correlated with the talking that's there that some of you experience. Inversely correlated with the mind wandering or trying to fix problem solve, that kind of thing. The way we know about that is whatever food you ate today. If you were very present with eating that food, it was you were present with the taste in your mouth. You noticed where the sensation of it was in the mouth, the taste in your mouth was so delicious. It was yummy if you had an experience like that. You probably weren't worrying too much about the next moment or rehashing a past event. If you're rehashing a past event or worrying about the next moment, you're eating your food, that food was gone and you didn't really taste it, right? So that's just a human experience of that inverse relationship with being present to something. And worrying and mind wandering and trying to fix and problem solve, that kind of thing, which oftentimes gets us in trouble. It increases what I call, as you're reading Uncovering Happiness, this depression loop that's there, this kind of suffering loop that's there in a lot of ways. When we put our hands on our chest or our stomach, the brain has to map that sensation. As it maps that sensation, that's the right, it's this right prefrontal shift over here, not in the prefrontal cortex, but this area, like this area of the brain that's kind of mapping the body, this area called the insula and some others, it's this right lateralized shift that's, again, not to confuse that with the right prefrontal area, but I'm confusing people, come talk to me after. And so, and when we do that, the activity in this cortical midline goes down. So if we want to reduce the volume on our self-critical mind, it's pretty imperative to get into our bodies sometimes, sense into being present in our lives in a lot of ways. Yoga is a fabulous way of doing that, or exercise is another wonderful way of doing that. It doesn't all have to be sitting on a cushion or a chair and doing a meditation practice. That's a wonderful thing to do to train your mind in that way, but there's other things in life that we can bring our attention to that also help with that too. And so there we have those other two natural antidepressants. Let me do a time check with you. We gotta wrap it up. Okay, so, all right. Having too much fun. Okay, good. So here's just a couple practices, right? So we have this, the practice where we kind of got the experience of what resiliency is like. We got the self-compassion practice, which is what I would do throughout the rest of this weekend. Is if you're having a difficult moment at any point, which is bound to happen, life is full of difficult moments, also full of good moments too, but you know, 10,000 joys, 10,000 sorrows. And so practice recognizing, like, whoa, this is a difficult moment right now. On a scale of 1 to 10, it might be a 2, 3, 4. Not a big deal. But it's a way to practice. It's difficult. Where are my feelings in my body right now? This feeling of anxiety or agitation or stress or tiredness, which a lot of people might be feeling here right now, if I see some yawning going on. And so, see if you can just, everyone will know what everyone's doing here as they're doing this, they'll be looking around. So you can just put your hand on your heart or your stomach or whatever. By the way, so I do this with a lot of executives as well, and it's not really that appropriate in their context to be in a boardroom meeting and just be like putting their hand on their heart. So I say, no one notices if you put your hand on your belly. You're still making that connection. You know what you're doing. They don't know what you're doing. Put your hand on your belly. It's a way of soothing in that moment. Ah, I recognize this is a difficult moment. They're there. And you're just kind of letting it settle into your sensing the connection. You're giving yourself the exact opposite of what you usually get, a or we usually get. It's the self-criticism, the self-judgment, the, ah, this again, what's wrong with me? We're actually tapping into the vulnerability. The 13th century Sufi poet Rumi said, don't turn your gaze, look towards the bandaged place. That's where the light enters. Look towards the bandaged place. That's where the light enters. That's why our vulnerability is where the gold is. If we can learn how to be with that, there's a gentleness that comes with it. There's a courage that comes with it. There's an empowerment that comes with it. There's a confidence that comes with it. Then no matter what happens in my life, I can handle it. I'm going to be okay. A sense of connection comes with that. So again, when we usually think of the word antidepressant, we oftentimes think of it as a pill, but we are recognizing now that we, neurobiologically, that we have, and just in our lives, that we have these natural antidepressants, and if we intentionally practice and repeat tapping into them, we're going to start making them more automatic. We can literally use our mind to change our brains in this way. And so there it is. So that's what I'll leave you with. So as we do that, we start to uncover the happiness that's been there. And that's kind of the essence of, I think, where I'm at right now in my life. So thank you. Thank you, everybody.